World News Today, brought to you by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas capitals, as well as the leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's John Daly with a summary of headline news as received in New York.
In these first days of 1943, we of the United Nations have set our feet firmly on the long road to victory. On the military fronts, we are on the offensive. It may be a long, hard pull, but we can face the future with confidence. Even in Tunisia, in French North Africa, the military situation looks bright. But at the same time, a political situation has developed which introduces a discordant note into the unity so necessary to our military operations. For the latest developments in French North Africa, Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS Algiers, Charles Collingwood reporting.
This is Charles Collingwood, Allied Force Headquarters in North Africa. Yesterday saw the most terrific air battles that have yet taken place in the North African sky. When the day was over, the scores stood 28 Axis planes destroyed by Tokyo and 34 damaged to 7 Allied planes shot down. This is the way it happened. A strong force of flying fortresses went out to bomb Tokyo. On the way back, the fortresses ran into a force of about 50 German and Italian fighters lying in wait for them over the Sina River. The 38 that were escorting the fortresses got two more and lost two himself. That makes 19 German planes down. The 20th was a Junkers 88.
We regret that interference makes Mr. Collingwood's report from Algiers unlistenable. He was reviewing the story of recent Allied air activity in which Allied bomber squadrons supported by P-38s and P-40s, our best fighter planes, have been smashing at all of the Axis supply ports on the eastern Tunisian coast. At Sfax and Gabas and Sousse, the Axis has been repeatedly bombed until those supply ports are reported in shambles. Insofar as the political situation is concerned, Generals de Gaulle and Giraud are now reported exchanging correspondence to arrange a meeting to iron out the political difference among Frenchmen fighting the Axis. The London spokesman of the Fighting French reports that further correspondence will be necessary, a not altogether promising sign. Next, for the news from the European front, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS London, Bob Trout reporting.
London, generally, is a pretty quiet place on Sundays. There's not really been what you would call a hectic Sunday since that Sunday the Allies landed in Africa. Today, London heard about the continued heavy Allied air attacks on the island of Crete, some of them made by United States Army Air Force bombers operating under the Royal Air Force Middle East Command. 30 of these American bombers took part in yesterday's large-scale daylight attack on Crete, the first big daylight raid on the island since the Germans captured it more than 18 months ago. From French North Africa came those dispatches to London, saying that the American flyers yesterday had their busiest day since the Allied landing. There was little news from the British First Army in Tunisia. Apparently, large numbers of American troops are still needed to police the areas in Algeria and Morocco, the communication lines, which the late Admiral Darlan was supposed to make safe. But there's never any news about that. Home-based Royal Air Force fighters were flying back and forth over the cold straits of Dover during the afternoon. Formations of high-flying fighters left their vapor trails in the clear, bright sky above the French coast. Four German fighter bombers dropped their bombs on a small southeast coast town of England, hitting an empty church and an empty school, as well as a few houses. When the four small German planes were seen coming in from the sea, they were high up and still climbing. Cautiously, they dropped their bombs from 15,000 feet, nearly 3 miles. As you would expect, some of the bombs fell into the sea. London Sunday newspapers printed prominently the United States State Department's white paper outlining the record of the American policy of avoiding war, which finally came to an end on that December 7th when the Axis countries demonstrated they were operating under a different policy. The London papers published the report under such headlines as U.S. was warned of aggression and U.S. was warned about Pearl Harbor attack year before Japan struck. Now back to New York and John Daly.
More news in just a moment, but first, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
Here's the picture of an event we hope never happens.
Why, Emily, there's nothing to fix in a radio. Here, let me show you. Stand back out of my way now. A couple of wires come apart. That's all the matter. Oh, broken. I've fixed it all right. The screwdriver slipped and smashed a tube. Emily, this would never have happened if you'd stood back like I told you.
And it never would have happened if that radio had been taken to an Admiral dealer for service. Now, a tube is broken, and since tubes are difficult to obtain, this family may have to do without radio until the war is over. Play safe. Make it your rule to call an Admiral dealer when your radio needs attention. Admiral dealers are trained in the science of radio. They are experts in servicing, and they have all the equipment and tools necessary to put your set in first-class condition quickly and economically. Radios are precious these days. Your set is worth more than you paid for it originally, because it probably can't be replaced until after victory is won. So treat it right. Call your Admiral dealer and know why people say Admiral service is America's assurance that the radios on the home front will last for the duration. Now here once again for Admiral Radio is John Daly.
The official midday communique from Moscow reported new Red Army advances on the central Stalingrad and Caucasus fronts. The communique was general rather than specific, but it reported that a strongly defended German base north of Veliki Luki was occupied and that the Red Army was 27 miles beyond Kotelnikovsky in the drive southwest of Stalingrad. The Germans are counterattacking both west and southwest of Stalingrad and west of Moscow, but the Russians report all attacks beat north and advances everywhere. For the moment, with the threat to Stalingrad lifted, probably the most important front is that west of Moscow in the vicinity of the German defenses in the Velikiye Luki-Rzhev-Vyazma area. Much of the future progress of the Russian winter offensives depends on the ability of the Red Army to maintain its momentum in their attacks on the hedgehog defenses in depth, which the Germans built in this area after the failure to take Moscow in 1941. Press dispatches from the front are a little more specific than the noon communique about operations near Velikiye Luki. But since they are dispatches, the news is, of course, unofficial. One dispatch reports that the Russians have cut the Leningrad-Vitebsk Railroad and advanced 14 miles along the Moscow-Rigo line to Novosokolniki, only about 70 miles from the Latvian border. The cutting of the Leningrad-Vitebsk Railroad may mean that the siege of Leningrad will be lifted. That city is now in its second winter of siege, and the fact that the Red Army is concentrating so much strength in the Velikiye Luki area is an indication that the lifting of the siege of Leningrad is also one of the objectives of the winter campaign. However, progress on the Central Front is comparatively slow and will probably remain so. The Germans have been digging in there for more than a year behind a formidable system of fortifications, including concrete pillboxes, trenches, anti-tank traps, and all the other types of World War II tested defenses. These defenses, as most of you know, were built by the late Fritz Todt, who built the West Wall on Germany's French border. They are the sort of defenses which the Russians have been banging their heads against for a good many months. For instance, in the offensive against Rzhev, the Russians, earlier this year, reached the outskirts of the city itself, only then to have to turn back and hold their front-line positions without making any great progress forward. Now, it's believed that the Russian armies have bypassed all of the Rzhev defenses, and Rzhev city itself is still in German hands. The fact that the armies can sweep around Rzhev, the Russian armies, and still leave the Germans inside the city attests to the importance of this new kind of fortification which was built by the late Fritz Todt. It's a fortification which must be slowly and systematically crushed. Another important factor in assessing the potential of the Russian offensives is the cost to the Russians in manpower and material. We have no idea as to the extent of Russian casualties since the winter offensive began well over a month ago. We can be fairly sure that they have been large, perhaps so large that the Russians will have to accept limited objectives for the winter campaigns. However, there is one clear indication that the Russians have all the strength they need. Military men point out that if it was necessary to husband manpower, the Russians would not have spread their attack over such a large area. For instance, considering the Red Army's successes before Stalingrad and in the Middle Don, it was hardly necessary to launch another offensive in the Nalchik region of the Caucasus. With the fall of Velikiye Luki, which, by the way, the Germans and their communique hint is still in their hands, there is good reason to feel that the Russian winter offensive will achieve successes that will perhaps even surprise the Russians themselves. Today, the communique, the noonday communique, which, as I said, was more general than specific, still reported that the Russian armies in all of the seven fronts in which they are now fighting are continuing to make advances. They're advancing in the center, they're advancing both north and south of Stalingrad, and they are advancing in the Caucasus in the Nalchik region. It's a feat which nobody expected of the Russians, at least at this early date. But we might all do well to remember the old adage, don't count your chickens before they're hatched. Next, Admiral Radio takes you to Columbia's correspondent in Cairo.
Professor Morrison in Cairo.
I am limited in the things I can say to you because the carrier system is in here. But in the past week, I have talked with many men. Men who knew what... with military and naval men, civilians, and...
We regret once again that interference has cut Mr. Morrison's report off from Cairo. This is evidently a bad day for shortwave broadcasting, but we will continue to call in CBS correspondents abroad, trying the Pacific area next. First of all, some of the news from Cairo, which Mr. Morrison was giving you. There is a hint today that a large-scale battle may be shaping up in Libya. It's reported that the British Eighth Army is now in contact with the Axis forces in the Wadi Bay al-Kiba area, about 180 miles east of Tripoli. But a British communique says there's nothing to report on the progress of activity. Yesterday, the British radio said that the Axis forces were digging in at a point slightly farther to the west along the line of the Wadi Zemzem, a rugged, dried-up watercourse. It declared that the Axis had assembled some tanks at that point and that the enemy troops were building trenches and throwing up fortifications. Once again, we look for heavy action in the Libyan fighting. But at the same time, we must remember that General Montgomery's 8th Army has stretched itself additional hundreds of miles away from its main supply bases. That even now, the principal secondary supply bases may be as far back as El Agheila, and it is going to take time to pull those supply forces forward so that the main armies can go into action. There has been increased action in the Pacific war area, so Admiral Radio turns next to CBS Honolulu, Webley Edwards reporting.
This is Pearl Harbor. The war on the vast Pacific front continues to step up in the frequency and intensity of aerial raids in the New Guinea, Bismarck Archipelago, and Solomon's Islands regions, with the news highlighted this week by the announcement of the raid on Wake Island by American bombers in force. There's bitter and savage fighting on the Papuan Peninsula of New Guinea, where Allied troops are continuing to cut up stubborn Jap forces in the pockets along the Buna Beach area. But beyond this ground fighting and the constant patrol fighting on Guadalcanal, the big story is on the sea and in the air. This is the world's longest battlefront, and its deepest. Land fighting is a series of battles for strong forts fought over perhaps bloody but relatively unimportant areas of land. It's the same out here, with surface ships and bombing planes fighting for strong points, which are strategic islands moving through or over great stretches of ocean to get to these strong points of land. The Wake Island attack is the third on that island, the first at low level. It was a soul-satisfying raid to all who remember the Marines' great stand a year ago. But it is still more significant than that. There were evidently large planes and force carrying some 75,000 pounds of bombs through to Wake Island without the benefit of any landmark at sea, found the Arabs, bombed it, and returned to their bases without mishap. Now mark this. Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet and Pacific Ocean Areas, made a significant remark in commanding on that raid. He said, and noted carefully, "Let the enemy take such consolation as he may from the thought that this raid is only a sample of things to come." Unquote. The Jap must now be alert wherever he holds land in the entire Pacific area. Ours is now the ability to choose the place where we will strike next and strike him first. It will come soon and also at a time of our choosing. Admiral Nimitz is not one to speak lightly. And when he says the Wake attack was but a sample, be assured he promises still greater attacks and still greater force. This despite the fact that the Pacific Fleet and the Pacific Army forces with relatively small aid from our allies, this Pacific force of ours is fighting a war against Japan, a major world naval and military power. This is Webby Edwards at Pearl Harbor. We return you to CBS in New York.
We've heard the news of Africa, Europe, and the Pacific. Now for some developments in Latin America, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Bogota, Jack Fendell reporting.
The war is being fought on many strange battlefronts and with many types of ammunition. This country is still neutral or non-belligerent. It broke diplomatic relations with the Axis powers right after the attack on Pearl Harbor. But part of the war is being fought today in the jungles of Colombia, only a few hours by plane from where I am speaking. Under the pressure of democracy's need for every ounce of rubber that it can scrape together, a force of Colombians and North Americans is cutting roads through jungles and laying out airfields so that the larger army of men who follow them will be able not only to gather rubber, but speed it onward to the United States. $1 million worth of United States money is the first ammunition in another phase of this war, as a group of American doctors and nurses starts a public health and sanitation campaign here. Their fight will be centered on disease germs that don't respect national boundaries and neutrality laws, and could easily spread to the nearby Panama Canal if unchecked. But while public opinion and many government circles here have centered their attention on domestic issues and economic problems, the Army is preparing for all eventualities and for the possibility that hostilities may come to be short. Under War Minister Alejandro Galvis, a recent nationwide conference of high-ranking Colombian Army officers adopted measures which will place the Army practically on a war footing. Not all of those measures can now be revealed, but they include a unified command which will assure more efficient execution of military plans and directives, and more advanced training methods and the lessons of modern warfare. It has likewise been announced that War Minister Galvis, together with a group of generals and other officers, will visit the Panama Canal Zone sometime this month to inspect the defenses there. While this will ostensibly be a courtesy visit, it will undoubtedly give the opportunity to the authorities of the Canal Zone to discuss more coordinated plans for the defense of the Panama Canal, to which Colombia is so important geographically. This is Jack Sandellis, over top, turning it now to CBS at New York.
We regret that atmospheric conditions have made so much interference in our shortwave pickups, but hope that the reports from Honolulu and Bogota were understandable. Now, for the news at home, Admiral Radio turns next to CBS Washington. Lee White reporting.
The Navy has just reported that American bombers in the Solomons have set one Japanese destroyer afire and left another in a sinking condition. The destroyer formation was first sighted off Shortland Island at 2:30 yesterday afternoon, Solomon's time. It was immediately bombed by a squadron of flying fortresses, but no hits were observed. 3.5 hours later, it was again attacked, this time off Rendova Island by a squadron of Douglas dive bombers protected by Wildcat and Aracobra fighters. The destroyers were escorted by Zero fighters, but these were taken care of by our own, while our bombers proceeded to bomb the surface squadron with good result. No more has been heard of the destroyer squadron since then, although it's reasonable to suppose that a number of ships got through to relieve the Japanese on Guadalcanal. There's been no land fighting on Guadalcanal of much importance lately. Just artillery duels, a clash between patrols now and then, daily air bombardments of the Japanese emplacements, and at least a daily raid on Munda, where the enemy is being harassed to prevent him from setting up a going airdrome. Major General Camel, Chief of Army Ordnance, announces that the production of tanks, guns, trucks, and munitions will be reduced in the coming year by from 10 to 20%. About $8 billion worth of contracts will be canceled. But more than this amount will be added to appropriations already outstanding for the manufacture of airplanes, merchant ships, and naval vessels. In 1943, according to the War Productions Board, we'll manufacture roughly 100,000 airplanes, with the emphasis on heavy bombers and cargo planes instead of fighters. Our merchant vessel goal for 1943 is 20 million tons. This year, we only produced 50,000 airplanes and a little over 8 million tons of merchant shipping. As you probably know by now, the value of Period 3 oil coupons will be cut at midnight to 9 instead of 10 gallons. And the issuance of B and C gasoline coupons will be resumed tomorrow, with the difference that this time a B card will only be good for 378 instead of 470 miles per month. You'll need a C coupon from now on, and they'll be hard to get if you have to travel 379 or more miles per month. Last night, the State Department issued a white paper on the tragic decade, beginning in 1931 with Japan's invasion of Manchuria and ending in 1941 at Pearl Harbor. It's 144 pages long and costs 25 cents. You can obtain it by writing to the Superintendent of Documents. I now return you to CBS New York and John Daly.
Here in New York is Columbia's military expert, Major George Fielding Elliott, with an analysis of the latest developments in the fighting in the Pacific. Major Elliott.
The capture of Buna Mission eliminates another Japanese foothold on the northern coast of Papua. But as General MacArthur is careful to point out in his dispatch, it does not mean that the Japanese resistance in this part of New Guinea has ended, as the Japanese still hold a well-fortified position at San Amanda Point. The tenacity of the Japanese resistance indicates that they are aware of the importance of their positions in New Guinea and suggests that they are trying to delay the development of a two-pronged Allied attack on Rabaul in New Britain Island, their principal advance base in the Southwest Pacific. The same consideration applies to the persistent and costly Japanese efforts to establish and operate an air base at Munda in the New Georgia Islands, which stands between Rabaul and Guadalcanal, much as Buna stands between Rabaul and Port Moresby. Should Japanese resistance at both these outlying posts be brought to an end, the way would be open for a twin advance of Allied forces with Rabaul as ultimate objective. Certainly the capture of Rabaul would not be easy. It is well fortified and will be stoutly defended. But with the loss of its covering outposts, it would be fatally isolated and exposed, and could be supported by the Japanese only from their great fleet base at Truk in the Western Caroline Islands, almost 800 miles away. It would, under such circumstances, be necessary for the Japanese to decide whether the retention of Rabaul was worth the risk of their whole remaining fleet in a great naval action to attempt to restore Japanese command of the sea in this area. If not, they could only bid their garrison at Rabaul sell its lives as dearly as possible, as has been done at Buna and on Guadalcanal. Why is Rabaul so important? To the Japanese, because it covers the approaches to Truk and is the keystone of all their outpost system in the Southwest Pacific. From our point of view, Rabaul is of great consequence because its secure possession would enable us to set up there a great submarine base, moving the point of departure of our submarines hundreds of miles nearer to their target area, which is the sea immediately south of the Japanese main islands. Our submarines have been doing magnificent work in the Pacific, striking at Japan's most vulnerable point, her merchant shipping. On this shipping, the whole future ability of Japan to carry on the war depends. Already, operating from their distant bases, our submarines have shown results, sub for sub, about three times as great as those obtained by the German U-boats from the Atlantic. If they can have the additional advantage of a forward base like Rabaul, they will do far better. And we have new submarines coming constantly into service. The possession of Rabaul would be to us an immense advantage, which the Japanese cannot possibly afford to let us gain if they can find means to prevent it.
Now here is Warren Sweeney with a word for Admiral Radio.
We're going to let you hear an authentic sound, the noise to be heard inside a tank during battle.
Third Battalion, advance to Hill 51. 3rd Battalion, advance to Hill 51.
That's the sound inside a tank during battle. And if you listen closely, you heard the tank crews getting orders by radio. Those radios, Admiral is making many of them, perform the miracles of this war. Credit for their design must go to the men of the Signal Corps. Credit for building them must go to American workers. The men and women, for example, on the assembly lines of Admiral's two great plants. Admiral workers are conscious that they're doing something bigger than they've ever done before. They're building radio equipment upon which American men will depend for safety, for efficiency, yes, and for their very lives. Good equipment is built because of this spirit. Victory will come sooner and at a far lesser cost because of it. And with victory, Admiral will again take its place as the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers. Have you heard the latest rumor? Then keep it to yourself. This doesn't mean Americans are forbidden to talk about the war. Talk about it all you wish. But don't mention something merely because you heard someone else say it. Talk only about the things you yourself read in a reliable newspaper or you yourself hear on the radio. Let's beat the Axis. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from the leading news centers of the world. Warren Sweeney speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is the WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.